Okay, we're off and running there. Okay, how many of you work out? Let's work out like a little bit. And do you listen to music when you work out?
Podcast.
Listen to music? Podcast? Well, see, okay.
Started going podcast.
There you go. That's kind of right. So when I work out, I usually often listen to music. Now, I might listen to the cool music that's piped in at the Richardson Rec Center, maybe like if it's the disco 70s on Saturday or whatever. Helps you move. I got an odd mix on my phone, though, so it might be Nirvana followed by Herman's Hermits, which is just weird. It's just weird. But I have taken to listen to podcasts, so it might be Malcolm Gladwell, Revisionist History, great stuff. This American Life, TED Radio Hour. I was listening to TED Radio Hour yesterday. And this lady came on, and she was talking about networks. Now, maybe not networks in the way that you would think of networks. But she was talking about this vast underground network of roots under the forest, under the ground in the forest. This vast array of a system of roots that transfers nutrients and chemicals between trees, even across species. And she began her talk by saying, years ago, I asked the question, do trees talk to each other? And at that point, I said, we'll turn this off. We're going back to Nirvana or something. I mean, let's leave that to George MacDonald and J.R.R. Tolkien or something. I don't know if I want to go there, right? But I left it on, which was good. It was a very, very interesting show. I'm not going to go into it. Interesting show. Suzanne Simard, I think, was her name, for what it's worth. So, but she's an ecologist, a forest ecologist. She's a scientist. And what are scientists trained to do? One of the first things a scientist is trained to do is what? To observe and ask questions. So she was just doing what she was trained to do, just asking questions. And some of the most interesting discoveries in the history of human endeavors in human history has been due to asking questions, sometimes really odd questions. Okay, so we ask questions, but all of us do, right? So it's not just scientists. Children ask questions. You know children ask questions. I read the statistic, and you know statistics are, you never know, right? But two or three places on that vast information superhighway, ever so reliable, of course, I've read statistics that children ask, on the average, about 288 questions a day. Now, they might be simple questions like, are we going to go out to eat tonight? You know, is it going to rain? Any number of things. The group that took the cake, though, was four-year-old girls. Four-year-old girls.
Do I hear a name?
Shaking your head, right? Good, night, do they ever, right? 380 questions a day was about the average for a four-year-old girl. It would make you think they probably do nothing during their waking hours but ask questions, which is just about right. Our daughter, I don't know, Juliet, she's not here, so I can say it. I was wondering if she'd be here. And I will say it now. I'd say it if she were here. I think for her, what stands out in my mind were pronouncements rather than questions, you know, statements. But she did ask a lot of questions. But we all do that. And maybe as parents, we don't all encourage those questions as we ought. We know deep down we really need to, but sometimes we're just like, give it a break, please, you know. You know, historically, there was a famous guy by the name of Socrates, or if you're a fan of Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, Socrates, dude. I do not. Socrates asked questions. He had this a method. I don't think he called it that. Somebody else did. Socratic method, or Socratic dialogue, which is just this idea that we ferret out ideas that are within our mind by asking questions and by engaging in dialogue. And so that's what he did. I taught for years, and my wife still teaches, at Covenant School. Tom Brown taught there. We are a classical Christian school, and part of what we do is engage in Socratic dialogue. You ask questions, and students learn by ferreting out those answers. It's not so much that there's a definite, concrete answer to everything. The fact of the matter is, we learn so much simply by engaging in that process of question asking. Why do we do it? You know, why do we ask questions? Why? It's human nature. What does it do? One of the things I think it does for us, and this isn't just me, obviously, it helps us discover. We know that. It helps us discover things like this forest ecologist discovered things by asking crazy questions like, do trees talk to each other? And children discover, and adults discover, woe to us when we get past the point of being able to ask those questions, right? They help us make sense of our surroundings. That's another thing that they do. And I want to suggest a third thing that they do is they encourage humility. Because we don't know everything, right? In Proverbs 26, Proverbs is full of chapters that contain couplets and contrasts and comparisons. And in chapter 26 of Proverbs, the first 11 verses, 10 out of the first 11 verses, talk about the fool. So I'll give you an example. Let me turn there real quickly so I can do that. Chapter 26 of Proverbs. The first verse, like snow in summer and like rain in harvest, so honor is not fitting for a fool, and so forth. Out of the first 11 verses, only one does not address the idea of a fool, and yet verse 12 says this. Do you see a man wise in his own eyes? There is more hope for a fool than for him. So he goes on and on talking about a fool, and then it says, but by the way, if you think you know everything, better off to be a fool. So we kind of set the stage here. It's a good thing to ask questions. It helps us in so many ways. It helps us learn things, but it also keeps us in the proper frame of mind it teaches us that we don't know everything. Voltaire said, judge a man by his questions, not by his answers. We have a good friend who he loves to ask questions. He'll pose questions to us to the point where sometimes we'll go, Michael, will you stop it? Cut it out, you know? But he has been incredibly instrumental in our lives with those challenging sorts of questions. What are some of the famous questions in history? I mean, Hamlet said, to be or not to be, that is the question, although that's kind of a statement, right? That's when I go, to be or not to be, that is a question? But it kind of is. Right? It's a question. And Hamlet, at that point, if you're savvy on the literary side of things, if you're not, don't worry, it's okay. Not everybody loves Hamlet and Shakespeare, but if you are, you know, he was questioning whether or not he wanted to live, okay? Is it better at this point to kill myself? Yikes. Epic question. Tough question. Then there's other questions. There's another literary question. Who is John Galt? Okay, you're familiar with Ayn Rand and Atlas Shrugged. Who is John Galt? Again, that's kind of a nerdy thing, but there you go. Other questions. How about this? Can a pregnant woman drive in the HOV lane? Oh, my goodness. No. You can noodle on that for a while. Why can't we just take man-made ozone and put it in the ozone hole, in the layer? I don't know. Why, does it really take 7 years for gum to digest in your gut? No. Okay, so enough of that. I mean, there are lots of questions we could ask. We're actually going to get to some serious ones. We are. But I want us to look at the questions that Scripture asks, that not only God asks of us, but that we ask of God. Okay? And let's remember that Jesus himself encouraged this sort of thing. In Matthew 7, he said, ask and you will receive, seek and you will find, knock and the door will be opened to you. He encouraged it. And again, I don't think he so much encouraged it because he wanted to give us a black and white, definite answer to everything in life. We're going to discover maybe more to the point, we're going to discover more of what he meant by asking questions and what it means to ask questions. I don't think the primary reason we ask questions is that so that we can have a definite answer that we then carry through life knowing that at any given point we can solve the ills in our life. They have a way of drawing out ideas, of ferreting out some things that are not true. Ask questions about Scripture. We need to ask questions when we look at Scripture. If you've ever taken a course or even just read about what you do, one of the things you do in Bible studies, you ask questions. You ask questions like, who's speaking? To whom are they speaking? And if we ask these questions and search out these answers, sometimes we get clarity on scriptural things that would otherwise be a little bit obtuse. In Psalm 11, 1 through 3, for instance, let me read that to you. Psalm 11, 1 through 3. It says, in the Lord I take refuge. How can you say to my soul, flee as a bird to your mountain? For behold, the wicked bend the bow. They make ready their arrow upon the string to shoot in darkness at the upright in heart. If the foundations are destroyed, what can the righteous do? Okay. Let's ask a question. Who is speaking? Well, someone is addressing the psalmist there. This advisor is addressing the psalmist, David in this case. And what he's saying is, flee as a bird to your mountain. David says, how can you, Mr. Advisor, say to me, flee as a bird to your mountain, blah, 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 blah. If the foundations are destroyed, what can the righteous do? But we take that verse 3 out and we say, oh my goodness. For instance, you know, the United States is in a fix. Oh no, woe is us because we've forgotten God. Now that's a separate issue. But the psalmist there wasn't saying, if the foundations are destroyed, what can the righteous do? He was saying, how can you say that to me? Because I know the Lord. And I know, verse 4, the Lord is in his holy temple. The Lord's throne is in heaven, and so forth. Okay? So if we ask, does that make sense? Is that clear? I'm not real sure. Yeah? In other words, the psalmist wasn't saying, if the foundations are destroyed, what can the righteous do? He was saying, don't you ask me that because you forget that I know the God who is in control. Okay? It's important to ask questions. Bottom line there. What are some of the questions that are in the Scriptures? Let's take a look at them. And as we do, I want us to think about the desires that they reveal. I think that questions reveal the desires in our hearts. Genesis 3, 9. God says to man, we're gonna just take this little thing out and ask, what does he mean by this? He asks the question, where are you? That's it, right? Where are you? So what was the context of that? So we need to look at that. What was the context of that question? Remember? In chapter 3 of Genesis?
Well, it was after they had eaten the apple.
Yeah.
And they realized they were naked.
Was it an apple? Sorry. Yeah. It's just another question.
Chinese pear.
Not many people know that. Yeah. Chinese pear.
They were yummy.
I've never heard of them. Okay. In the context of that, of having committed that sin, God comes looking and says, where are you? Now, let's remember. Pretty much, well, no. Every question that God asks of man is more or less rhetorical, right? Right? Okay. So when he says, where are you? It wasn't a good night. Oh, stop it. I'm done with hide and seek, guys. No, he knew, but he was asking, okay, what was his desire? What was God's desire when he asks? What was it?
Engagement.
Yeah. Come out. Yep.
Yeah.
The question that God asks of man is, where are you? He asked this of Adam after the sin, after he had the fall.
We're talking and looking at it slightly in a different context than I did before. I would say context is more spiritual, obviously not physical, if you already knew where you were.
Sure.
But where are you spiritually? Is that more of what have you done to separate yourself from it?
Yeah. There was more to the question than the simple, straightforward, where are you? As with when we ask our children, what are you doing?
Nothing.
Yeah, there's both more in that question and in that answer, right? where are you can be understood to also include, are you getting in trouble? Right? It is the first time that that a question is asked at all.
Yes, and every day you go out in the garden and fellowship.
Right.
Yeah. This evening he asked the question. This is the first time.
I think it is the first. I think it is the first question that is asked at all in Scripture. It's a good point. What's that?
The serpent
asked questions
before that.
That's true. Yeah, which are wonderful, evil but wonderful. I mean, you know, questions. So the desire again to look at the desire behind the question, the desire of God was to be with man. He didn't ask him, where are you, because he was ignorant. He didn't even ask him necessarily, where are you, because he was angry. He asked him because he wanted to know man and to be with man, and man had chosen to walk away. Here's another one. In just two verses later, in fact. Adam says, I heard the sound of you in the garden, and I was afraid because I was naked, so I hid myself. And in verse 11, what does God ask Adam? Yeah. Who told you you were naked? Who told you you were naked? What is the desire there? Why would he ask that? We don't have to just look at the desire. Let's ask further questions like you all have, like what's behind that, or what's also included in that question. What's included in the question, who told you you were naked? It wasn't me. Yeah. What else was included in there, and what does it show? What have you done to...
You've something, and you've changed your lens. What have you done to change your lens?
Mm-hmm. Okay, seeking confession. What have you done? What has changed? You've been talking to somebody else? Yeah.
I try to put myself kind of in the shoes of Adam and think, okay, I've had communication with God. I know who he is. What is this serpent coming here and talking to me? Where did you come from and why are you asking these questions?
Uh-huh.
And I kind of think, is that really what God's trying to get to as to... Someone gave you information, but didn't you question as to where their information is coming from? Or the authority they have in order to even approach you?
Mm-hmm. Right. Yes. It's great to put yourself in that position, because it helps us, for one thing, again, with asking questions, it keeps us humble, right? Rather than saying, I would have never done that, we probably realize that, wow, there were a number of things going on, I could have just as easily fallen. Anything else about that question? Yes. 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 He's wanting them to think about it. He asked them a very, very simple question that then elicits further response and further thinking. And he doesn't come at this accusatory. There is not this tromping through the garden, fee fi fo fum, you know, I smell the blood of an Englishman, not in this case. I mean, there isn't that. There is this sense of, you know, it's a drawing in. It's a pulling in. I mean, even when God did things that we think are harsh, and we'll get to Job in a minute, right? It's not a pushing away, it's a pulling in. It's the same thing we do as parents, right? We want to pull our children in, even when we say to them, we need to talk. Okay? I love you, but here's something that just we can't do this, you know? What are we doing? We're not pushing away. And I think we are. For all the world, we may be afraid that that's what's going to happen. But we're really pulling them in. And that's what God is doing in these two verses. Where are you? Who told you you were naked? Let's reevaluate. Like you said, reevaluate where these questions came from. What's the authority? And well, we could talk about those questions that Satan asked too, that the serpent asked. really fascinating. Let's, in fact, I didn't have this down, but let's look at one of them since you brought that up. Let's see. Yeah, here we go. Let's take the very first question that the serpent asked of Eve in chapter 3, verse 1. He said to the woman, "Indeed, as God said, you shall not eat from any tree of the garden." Okay, what's wrong with that question, based on what we know about what God said?
Wrong.
It's wrong. Why was it wrong?
Because there was one specific tree there would not eat.
There was only one. Has God said to you, don't eat from any of the trees? And the proper answer from Eve would have been what? No. Get out of here. You know? Yeah, were you listening? She wasn't that smart. This is the sort of thing that, you know, that children also do, right? The presumption that God doesn't want the best for us. The parents don't want the best for us, even as we presume sometimes God doesn't want the best for us. Well, you won't let me do this. Yeah, but let me count the 37 other things I say are okay for you to do. Oh, I don't want to know that. I just want to do this. That's human nature.
Well, it goes back to the Proverbs you just had us read on Proverbs 26, where it said, do not answer a fool according to his folly. So the serpent has a folly question. You know, God not love you, like created you, he did a billion things for you. Surely he doesn't love you. But it's a folly question.
Yeah.
And Adam and Eve answered them according to the folly.
Yes, yes. It was a foolish question to ask, a senseless, but it wasn't in line with what God had already revealed about himself. You know? And there are questions, you know, how many of you are teachers or have been teachers? I know several of you, right? So you know that there's that standard line of only stupid question is the one you don't ask. Now, occasionally with my students, I'd want to say, that's not true. See that one you asked right there? I don't teach anymore. No, I'm kidding. I didn't usually say that. No, I don't think I ever said that. But occasionally I would say, really? I mean, you know, there are those questions that are just foolish questions.
I think it's interesting the contrast of two questions, because the serpent is asking a question intentionally, asking a question inaccurately, intentionally setting up deception. Yeah. So he starts with deception in this question because he wants to lead to deception. God asks questions with absolutely no deception in them because he's trying to lead them to a place of truth. They have fallen to deception.
Yeah.
He's trying to bring them back to truth. So God's questions are always rooted in truth. And he doesn't ask deceiving questions. He asks questions that present truth to get back answers that are true.
Yeah, there you go. There's always the issue of why someone asked the question. So this idea of desire, what's the desire? The other thing I thought about, what does it reveal? What does a question reveal about the character of a person, the nature of a person? And I think that oftentimes, I mean, certainly in this case, the serpent, it revealed very clearly his nature. And we know that, 20/20 hindsight. They didn't know it at the time, but that is what it revealed about the character of the serpent. Let's move on. Feel free to chime in. But let's move on to Job. I mentioned that a second ago. God asked Job in chapter 38, verse 4, he said, "Where were you when I laid the foundations of the world?" Now, little side note. Job 38 and 39 have more questions, I don't know, more questions than anywhere else, but very likely more questions asked in a short period than anywhere else in the Bible. God over and over and over asks Job these questions, and as you know, he can't really answer them. But why does he do it? Because here we have this patron saint of suffering, and God is just bam, bam, bam. What's he doing? I mean, this is rough. Now, we have to know, we have to believe, first off, in the nature, the character of God, who is asking the questions. And if God is a good God, and we start with that as a given, then obviously if we don't think it's good, then we don't understand good. When we ask these questions, they are for the purpose, again, of drawing him back. And he ultimately uses these questions to move Job beyond his suffering. And we could talk more about Job and what had preceded this assault, as it were, of questions in chapter 38. We could talk about him listening to his advisors and about Job's statements, some of which might be seen as a bit presumptuous. But the truth of it is, they're harsh questions, but they were intended to draw Job back and really, in a sense, to put him in his place. But also, and you mentioned this last night, we were talking about it, to show what God's place is. Not just what Job's place is, but what God's place is. And only when Job understood those two things clearly could he have peace. You know, you can kick, as Jesus, when he appeared to Saul on the road to Damascus, he said, "It is hard for you to kick against the goats, isn't it? It is tough. It hurts, doesn't it? You keep trying that. See how that's going to do for you. Where is that going to get you?" And God told Job, if you will understand where you were, and by the way, where you weren't when I laid the foundations of the world, and where I am and who I am, we can be okay with this. It's not that simple. I do not want to simplify the situation of Job. I don't know what that's like, but I do know the character of God, and the nature of that question was to bring him back. Any other comments, though, on Job? Because there's tons to talk about there, but why do you think the questions were there, maybe? And there were a lot of them. Any other comments on that?
Well, right.
That's a great point. That he says, well, okay, you have yours, now let me pose mine. I mean, and it wasn't a matter of one-upmanship, but it's just, I've got some questions too, and they're going to help you work through some of yours, maybe. Terribly hard place.
And to punch through to that, it took a lot more than it would be in a situation where you're just sitting here or we're sitting before God asking him to help us understand something.
Yeah, yeah.
In a positive way, not in a...
Yeah, the tough love idea. I'm blanking on the name of the movie. Help me out. It's a Robin Williams, Matt Damon movie about the brilliant Goodwill Hunting. Yeah, Goodwill Hunting. You remember the scene, if you've seen it, in Goodwill Hunting, where Robin Williams takes him and Damon is working through some past pain, and he says, "It's not your fault." I know. It's not your fault. It's not your fault. It's not your fault. And he grabs him and he shakes him and he hugs him. It's not your fault, until Damon just breaks down crying because he hasn't dealt with some of this past pain with his father. It was the main issue there. You know, it was done, the statement in this case was done, he was punching through, wasn't he? He was pushing through. And God uses that with Job, and he uses that with us as well. Let me do one more question that God poses. In this case, the second person of the Trinity, Jesus, poses and to man. And that is in Mark chapter 8, verse 27. Mark 8, 27. Mark 8 starts off with the feeding of the 4,000, the second feeding of the multitudes, and the gathering of the baskets afterwards. And then there is this healing of a blind man, where Jesus spits in his hands and he puts this mud on this man's eyes, and he washes and he can see. And then he comes to his disciples, and as they're walking along, it says in verse 27, he questioned his disciples, saying to them, Who do people say that I am? And then they answer. And he says, who do you say I am? And the patron saint of foot in the mouth. Actually, in this case, right, wonderful, wonderful opening of mouth. Says what? Peter says what? The Messiah. You're the Christ, the Son of the living God. Imagine, sometimes I think of him having said that and going, oh, did I just say that? I mean, really, it sounds funny, but I mean, there's this sense of like, oh, what happened there, right? And then there are other times where he goes, oh, I wish I could take that back, right? But God, Jesus asked two things. Who do people say that I am? And who do you say that I am? What was the desire of Jesus when he says to them, who do people say that I am? Does he want to know? Tell me, gossip. What are they saying? Are they talking bad about me? Really? Come here. You didn't say that, you know. What was the desire when he says, what do people say?
I think you see the distinction between what was true about him and what other people perceived.
Yeah.
Was there a method, too? Like, these other methods you're talking about, the scientific method and the Socrates method?
I think absolutely. I mean Socrates came up with it, but obviously we know it goes further back. But it's the idea throughout history that asking questions, in this case, a simple question, are going to bring up something beyond the simple answers. So who do men say that I am? Yeah, and that's kind of why I was saying, I wondered, Peter just blurted it out, and where did that come from, right? He was indeed saying, let's compare what they say to what you observe about me. Because over and over, Jesus would say, are you still so hard of heart? Do you still not get it? Again, kind of a harsh thing, in a way, for Jesus to talk that way to people. Don't you get it? Are you so stubborn? It was the healing of this man born blind, and then the feeding of the 4,000. And then after that, they were just walking along, and seemingly, not out of nowhere, because if we think about it, maybe he was thinking, okay, based on the miracles that these 4,000 just saw, based on the miracle of healing a man born blind that they just saw, what do they think? You're a really good doctor. No. Yes. Yes. There's plenty of references that they should have known, and they did know, right? And there's the puzzle. Right? These are a bunch of good Jewish boys following a rabbi. He was the one that they were going to follow, as many did, right? And he was the one that they chose to follow, and they should have known the scriptures, and they really did, but what was it? I mean, they somehow missed, I don't know. I mean, I'm sure I would have missed it too. But yeah.
But I think it's fascinating when you look at the mark of the whole, it's just they're leaning towards one definition of him based on their need. Mm-hmm. Healing was something that he was very much recognized for and talked about a lot in Mark, and the crowds were coming to him for healing a lot. And he thought the healing and saying, don't tell anyone I need to.
Yeah.
And they were labeling him specifically as a healer because that was such an immediate physical need, something that people get urgent about. And, you know, we all know we prioritize our physical needs over our spiritual needs. So they weren't like, oh, I need the Messiah to come save me in a spiritual way. Those who were excited about the idea of the Messiah were looking for the return of a kingdom.
Yeah.
And to, you know, throw off Roman rules. So I just think it's neat that he contrasts the two questions. And he asks him, who do people say I am, knowing that they've heard all these different things that people are saying. And then he goes back to the UK and he says, who do you say I am? Looking for them to distinguish themselves from everyone else. He's letting them know because he's not asking a question that doesn't have the answer. And he said he's asking a question that makes them think. So I feel like he's making I want you to recognize that who you say I am should be a different answer than who everyone else says.
That's a great point. Yeah, there needs to be a distinction. There were times when Jesus would talk to large groups, Sermon on the Mount, and then he would talk to smaller groups. And then at one point we find that there were 70 who got culled down to eventually 12, right? And as many of them left, Jesus said, "Are you going to leave me?" And Peter, wasn't it Peter also, I think, who said, "Where are we going to go? You have the words of life." So there was this culling, this narrowing down of these groups. And at some point, I think he was probably going to ask them, "Do you think the way they think? Because you may be discovering that that things are a little bit different than what they believe them to be." And when Peter states it outright, there it is. He blurts it out. Let's look at a couple, just so we can move on to the questions that I haven't gotten to, which are questions that man asks of God, and we'll have time to get to a couple of them anyway. My God, why have you forsaken me? Psalm 22:1, and also what Jesus said on the cross. What a heart-wrenching question. Absolutely heart-wrenching. What does it mean? What does it tell us about the desire of the psalmist and later of the psalmist's heir, right? Jesus. What does it tell us? There's a sense of separation. Yeah. Yeah. There's agony involved. There's loss. What else does it tell us about the desire of the psalmist? What is that? Acceptance. Wanting God to accept him. Wanting the presence of God. I'm sure many of you have gone through difficulties. Maybe they were, you could directly assign some external circumstance to these difficulties. Other times you don't know where it came from, but maybe there's anxiety, maybe there's depression, maybe there's discouragement of some sort, and you don't know what's going on there. And the only thing you can ever do is get on your knees before God, and as a friend of mine says, sometimes all he can cry out is, "Lord, hold me together or I'm going to fall apart." And when you get there, you identify with the psalmist. You identify in a way with Jesus. You're not afraid to question the absence of God. And I think the fact that you question the absence, you question whether or not God is there, is itself a step of faith. You didn't think God was there, you wouldn't be crying out to God anyway. You wouldn't be saying anything to him. Yes? Yeah. Right. I think it was, yeah.
That gray guy. Uh-huh. You know, where else am I going to go? Because it must have, I would think it would gross everybody out. I have no idea what you just meant, and so many people laugh, but it's
yep.
Like nobody would say, I don't really have an option to say anymore. I don't get what you just said.
That's a That is a great, great point. We forget that sometimes. We have these stock answers that we think people need to give us and that we need to give people, right? And that's not true. And when you hear something like Jesus saying, "You need to eat of my flesh and drink of my blood." What? Okay, what? And so, yeah, that was the point at which, I thank you for reminding me of that context. That was the point at which they said, "We're done." And then Jesus says, "How about you?" And no, you're it. You're all we got. So there's that sense of knowing that without the presence of God, I am totally, completely lost.
Well, David, in that song, is that a song where you
sing? That's later. Well, I don't know if it's chronologically, but it's later in the Psalms. No, at this point, I think he's crying out against about the those around him who are assaulting him. in one way or the other, chasing him down, maybe. A couple of other questions. Oh, sorry. Where can I go from your spirit, or where can I flee from your presence? Psalm 139. That right there was a rhetorical question on the part of the psalmist. And this is one of those questions that, this, to me, the desire there is to worship God. He says, if I go here, you're there. If I go here, you're there. It's so wonderful. You're everywhere. Where can I go from your presence? There's the question. And the answer built in is nowhere. And that makes me so very happy. You know, and the psalmist was praising God. So the desire there was to affirm the presence of God and to worship him in that sense. One more question, and this is one of those that we really have to ask about the desire behind this one. It's a little nefarious. In Luke chapter 10, Jesus says, Jesus is talking about, let's see here. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, your soul, your strength. Love your neighbor as yourself. And then this lawyer to whom Jesus is talking wants to justify himself, and he says, who's my neighbor? And Jesus answers with the story of the Good Samaritan, which was, in the minds of those who heard, rather a contradiction in terms. And so he addressed some issues of prejudice at that point, for sure. But he also said, basically, your neighbor is the one that is in your path. And the question, though, was why? Why was the question asked? What does it represent about the desire of the individual? In fact, it's built into that verse. Wanting to justify himself, he asks this question. So sometimes we ask questions because we want to justify ourselves. Not a good reason to ask a question. So this is a way in which we reveal the motive, and God over and over and over talks about the importance of that in our lives. We need to stop. It's rather an abrupt ending, but I want us to think maybe in this coming week about the questions that God asks of you and the questions that you ask of God, and be aware of the questions that others are asking. And is your desire to draw them in? Is your desire to show them the heart of God? Or do you take their questions to be an assault and an affront? Maybe you get questions that you don't like, but maybe they show you something about both your heart and the heart of the one who asks.
There's a really good book on evangelism called Questioning Evangelism. It's the art of questions.
Yeah.
And so I highly recommend it.
Questioning Evangelism. Okay. What's that? All right, well, that's it. John, would you close us in prayer?
Yes, thank you. Thank you for Stephen coming and talking with us. We thank you that you can...